Good. A reminder that this is very much a transatlantic alliance. My name is Lise Doucette, and I am from Canada. But I do work for the BBC, the same organization as my colleague Nick Gowing, and he very rightly said this morning that this space is very daunting indeed. But of course, you have to remember that Nick grew up on a very small island, and I grew up on one of the biggest land masses in the world. But he did but he did a very good job indeed for pointing out, and I would like to think that this very unwieldy room is not a metaphor for NATO dealing with a very unwieldy world with all of its security challenges. And on top of it, we have a clock that is stuck at 9:05. Now, Madeleine Albright has just implored us to think about the 21st century. And that is indeed what we are going to do. We shall pretend that we have reacted immediately to her call for a discussion about the future. An alliance of the future, a 21st century institution for the 21st century. We are being asked to consider two big questions in this next session. The first, will the future of security be different from the past? Now, given what we've seen in recent decades, the very short answer is yes. The long answer is breathtaking and possibly life-taking on a massive scale. Is it going to be a bloody century? Insecure, dangerous, tasking the resources and the capability, if not the will, of NATO. The second question. Where are we going with human security? Well, it depends how we define human security. And let me just pick up on a few of the points that were mentioned today. Jaap Hoepskeffer started the day saying that, of course, we consider human security. It's part of the responsibility to protect. And then he said, when he gave his own remarks on the concept of a new security concept, he said, well, it only makes sense if we remove the distinction of our security within NATO borders and security in the rest of the world. A good comment. But Mohammed al-Baradei, gracefully but with nuclear precision, destroyed that when he said, what does human security mean if you cannot send a single helicopter to Darfur? And if it's a question of survival, then the public has to be on your side. But which public? Throughout the day, we've talked about the milkman from Omaha. But I would hazard that if we're going to change the security concept, the strategic concept, we have to change the security quote. Because it's no longer just about the milkman from Omaha, it is about the goat herder from Kandahar. The man who sees NATO troops with all kinds of accents and uniforms going by. How does he understand NATO? Now, we don't understand what the goat herders in Afghanistan are saying, but if we believe Daniel Korsky, who quoted the polls and says one after the other, they say, we don't care about NATO, then what about the idea that also runs through this conference, that is there a shared perception of the security risks at present and in the future, which crosses the Atlantic? And what are those security threats? We want to look at them in this session. If, as Lord Levine says, that these security risks have been around for centuries, be it piracy, be it the security problems, and God forbid if NATO now has to start worrying about cows and pigs and, well, if it's goats, we have the goat herders from Kandahar to help us. But what can NATO do? And as the Secretary General says, what should NATO do? This is the topic for this discussion. And I'd like to continue the tradition set up by Nick in that we should keep the papers coming here. We'd like to have lots of suggestions. And why don't you take a moment while you're thinking about a question or a comment to list the things that you do not think NATO should have any involvement with, be it human security, or rather be it energy security, be it climate change. If there are red lines for you, please mention them so that NATO can consider whether or not it should consider them at all. But first, we're going to go to our panelists. And it's a credit to NATO that they have brought in a wide range of opinions. Mary Caldor, who's come from London, is head of the Centre for the Study of Global Governance at the London School of Economics. She has been writing about human security for a very long time and reminding NATO that security is not just about aerial bombardments, that the soldier's job is to protect civilians. So even before all those soldiers with PhDs came up with counterinsurgency and population-centric notions, Mary Kaldor was writing about human security. Josette Chiran heads the world's largest humanitarian organization, the World Food Programme. Now, she called on NATO to help her with the delivery, a very dangerous delivery, of food supplies to Somalia. And NATO did that for a while. And I think Yaptub Skefer got awarded the WFP Red Cup. Well done, but there may be more to do. And just to balance it out, rather than being given gifts, we've got a man who the Secretary General gave a gift to, and that is Alexander Vondra, who joins us today, the former Czech Foreign Minister, former Deputy Prime Minister for European Affairs, and he was given the NATO Meritorious Award. And he is a reminder of the unpredictability of security, because sadly he had to step in at the very last moment when Ivan Rostov went ill. But thank you very much for joining us. And when I said to him today, I said, Alexander or Sasha, what do you want to talk about? What are you going to tell us? He said, I'm going to be realistic. And then he said, and I'll be an Atlanticist as well. So first of all, let me call on you, Josette. You created a little stir last year in London when you said a hungry world is a dangerous world and that the impending food crisis was a silent tsunami. Tell us in 6 minutes what you think of human security and in which way at all can NATO play a role?
Well, thank you, and I'm so pleased to be here. I'd like to talk a little bit about a topic that's a little different than humanitarians are used to talking about, which is that our work can no longer be just left to do-gooders and well intentions. That our work is so linked to the concepts of stability in a very complicated world, and we are so interconnected, that we need a better dialogue while we honor each other's space and do each other's work. And I'd like to present the argument that if the World Food Program can do its work well, we can perhaps save the militaries of the world from much more complex, complicated, more entrenched problems. I'd like to start with just three stories. One is with the pirates in Somalia. When I first came to the World Food Program 2 years ago, the World Food Program was then, as it is today, feeding about half the population of Somalia. Why should NATO care? Why should the world care about that? Why, in fact, are your nations funding that? Because if people leave Somalia, if people don't have food, one of three things happen. They migrate, they revolt, or they die. And the world has decided that these are not optimal situation in this situation, and plus with about 100 million other people we reach in the world every day. That supply chain, as anyone in the military would know, to feed half the population of Somalia in a dangerous environment tells you about how good my people are. In fact, I have a couple of my operational leaders here with me today. But when pirates were attacking our ships, WFP has not even a pocket knife to defend itself. And if that supply chain got cut off, we're talking about destabilization of an entire region. When I called NATO, first of all, we don't have your telephone number. We didn't know how to call you, because that dialogue doesn't exist. But when I approached defense ministries and NATO, in fact, the world did act, not to deliver the food, but just simply to give an escort to our ships. And that has kept that supply chain open, and in a very unstable part of the world, a stability where that population doesn't have to get on the move and on their feet. Second story I'd like to tell is about Myanmar and Burma after the cyclone there. The World Food Program coordinates logistics for the entire UN system. We negotiated the opening to get in finally and reach people. But we were not able to get in helicopters big enough and able enough to reach the complex areas cut off. And it was the Canadian military that helped us bring in helicopters to be able to get in there. That was life-saving action that we couldn't solve on our own. I'd like to also point out a different thing, which was when we finally reached people, a bag of rice didn't do it. There was no cooking fuel, no water, And in fact, I talked to the Indian military, who helped us with meals ready to eat, from defense technology, packages of food pre-cooked with vitamins and mineral that could save children's lives. And so that connection had never happened before, but an interesting and important one where we can help reinforce each other's life-saving missions. I'd like to talk briefly about Gaza. We had the leader of our Gaza operations in December and January. I got to the border and found out that people didn't have cooking fuel, hospitals didn't, doctors couldn't eat, patients couldn't eat, there was no water and was no electricity. And again, we were able to get the Jordanian military to bring in within 12 hours a C-130 with 80,000 meals ready to eat that could keep those hospitals functioning. But again, I didn't have the ability to solve that problem within our world. Let me mention Pakistan, 3 million people displaced. We're working with the government in partnership with the government of Pakistan. They've asked us officially to run this food supply chain in addition to the 8 million people who are already reaching there. Extremely complex, and in something, I don't know if Madeleine Albright is still here, that I thought really was a symbol of a new way of thinking, the U.S. announced a joint announcement by the State Department and Defense Department of $36 million, not only to reach that population with food, knowing how destabilizing it would be if that didn't happen, but also to purchase wheat locally, because the food supply chain was being broken down, and if that food isn't being bought, and if that whole supply chain breaks, and that helped us be able to purchase the food locally, reach the people locally, and help stabilize the situation. And Afghanistan in Kandahar, I was just in Canada, and the military asked to meet with me, and they said, we want to talk about how brilliant your stabilization efforts are in Kandahar. I said, tell me what you think we're doing that's so brilliant. And they said, WFP reaches school children with a red cup. The red cup we awarded the Secretary General, this one comes from Rwanda, for one out of six people in the world today, they wake up and aren't sure they can fill this cup with food. That's how profound our hunger challenge is. But in Afghanistan, WFP feeds many school children, including in Kandahar, with the help of the Canadian government. Instead of just doing it on our own, we work through the education councils. And for the first time in Kandahar, apparently, there is a contract between the people and the government which simply provides a cup of food for children. Now when you ask people in Kandahar, what does your government do for you? They have an answer, because this program is extremely popular throughout the world. And I was told, for the military on the front lines there, it's cooling things down. It's a stabilizing effect. Now, I'm not saying we need joint strategies, but the theme between all these stories is they were all ad hoc, not really connected, the conversation wasn't there, on how we can avoid worse situations or stabilize and cool things down. Last year, we did see hunger on the march. We saw the world's first globalized humanitarian crisis. And just to show how interconnected we are, to answer the question in your white paper, or discussion paper for today, are we in a different environment than 99? I would say yes, because we are so interconnected that if something happens in one place, it immediately gets reflected elsewhere. And I will just leave you with this story. I was wondering, how is it that food prices doubled overnight everywhere in the world? And for the bottom billion, they lost half their food, which meant most of them didn't eat one day and the next day they ate. Very destabilizing, riots in 30 countries. Haiti lost its government. This is important for NATO to understand, everyone to understand, how did this happen? I was in the market in Ethiopia in a stall, donkeys, no electricity, talking to traders. And I said, why are your food prices twice as much as they were 12 weeks ago? And the trader said, every morning I go on the internet, Chicago Board of Trade, I set my prices, I discount them 10% for import parity, and that's what I sell it for. I thought, amazing. You go to village after village around the world, and we are interconnected in ways that we don't understand, but we better get very smart about if we want to look at a more stable world. I'd like to make a few appeals here today. We don't need NATO to solve this, but if I could just
very quickly,
if I could just mention three things. One, Help us get ahead of the hunger curve. It is cheap at the price. Last year, Liberia thought their government might be destabilized for $14 million. Stability happened. Last time, Liberia didn't have enough food, 20 years of civil war and suffering. Secondly, advocacy. If NATO and the military say, this is important, reaching those 3 million people in Pakistan is important, it makes the job of aid agencies much easier and my impossible job of raising all voluntary money much better. Third, support the humanitarian lifeline when necessary. Let's get smart about things like piracy, because if it's cut off, it will make your job much harder. And fifth, do we need to think about emergency stocks? There was not enough food to get around last year. We have a serious food problem. We can talk more about it. In part, it's energy and food markets converging, creating a disruption that is very destabilizing. But I want to thank you for having us here today and opening this dialogue.
Thank you, Josette Ciaran. Now that you found NATO's telephone number, do you think you will be calling it more, or do you think that NATO, when it's considering its strategic concept, should also include food security? Or would you say, no, I'm a humanitarian organization, they are a military alliance, we'll keep it to ad hoc, let's not blur it.
We've seen a paradigm shift in food security. We no longer are in a food surplus world, and we have to get very smart about access to food. And so I think that any military organization, any defense or security organization that does not consider what Admiral Blair, President Obama's security advisor, did, the effects, the destabilizing effects when people don't have enough to eat, it's very, very critical. So I would say let's learn what the Roman Empire learned from Mark Antony and Cleopatra. They cut off the wheat supply, brought an empire to its knees. You cannot mess around with food security. We have to get very smart about it and make sure we know where we're headed.
Thank you, Josette. Now, I don't know what it is, whether it's the lunch, it's the day, it's as concise as the air, but I haven't got a single suggestion or question about looking to the future. I don't want to conclude that nobody has any ideas or opinions about the future, so I'm going to put another call out for some questions or comments. And we're going to turn to Mary Caldwell. Now, Mary, when NATO celebrated its 50th birthday, you said they should shift from a defense of the West to upholding international law. And you've launched many salvos since then about human security. What is human security for you, and what does it mean to NATO's strategic future?
Well, again, thank you very much for inviting me. And I think this thinking about NATO's strategic concept is a really important and interesting initiative. As Lisa said, I've been thinking about human security for some time. I convened a study group which reports to Javier Solana, and it includes both practitioners and academics, and our conclusions are derived from a lot of research we do on the ground. So what I thought I would do would be to briefly describe what I and the group mean by human security, and then talk about, very briefly also, its relevance to NATO. Somebody said, is NATO still relevant? Do we need it? And I've been trying to think what is its relevance, and one of it is that it does represent a very important military instrument. But I do think it's a military instrument that needs to be directed in a new way towards, if you like, global security, international rule of law. And so let me explain what I mean by that. Well, my starting point is the security gap, which several people have mentioned. We live in a world where large numbers of people live in situations of deep insecurity, whether it's due to political violence, terrorism, crime, climate change, natural disasters, disease, hunger. And yet what we call our main security instrument is actually largely based on conventional military forces designed for war fighting, and not only war fighting, but also largely on European territory. And that's a huge gap. And I think our existing security instruments not only can't meet those sources of insecurity, it can sometimes make those sources of insecurity worse. At one point, Laurie Friedman said, NATO's conventional and nuclear military capabilities represents a very important deterrent. And I suppose my question is it a deterrent If it were just that, it would be fine. But does it actually provoke, not only in the way that Mr. Baradai suggested, it might actually encourage others to get nuclear weapons, but also does it provoke asymmetric ways of getting around these military capabilities, whether it's cyber warfare, terrorism, or does it lead to climate change or divert money from hunger? So those are questions that we need to ask. I think the concept of human security does offer a framework for addressing these new sources of, or they're not actually new, but addressing today's main sources of insecurity. I know most people are familiar with the concept, but I'd like very briefly to define it or to give my version. First of all, it's about the security of individuals and communities, as opposed to, but not necessarily in contradiction to, the security of states and alliances. Secondly, it's about the link between freedom from fear and freedom from want, physical and material insecurity. I know there's a big debate between what's called the Canadian version, around responsibility to protect, that's about freedom from fear, and the so-called UNDP version, which is about freedom from want. My view is that freedom from fear is central, but you can't deal with freedom from fear without the interlinkage with freedom from want. And thirdly, and this is something the Secretary General said this morning, it's about the internal as well as the external. It's about not only individuals and communities who live in the NATO area, who have been always experienced human security, actually. It's about spreading human security to the rest of the world. It's about doing security abroad as we do it at home, which means it's much more about extending the rule of law than it is about fighting traditional wars. So what kind of things do we need to do that kind of human security? Well, I think many people have said we need a combination of military civilian capabilities, and that's at the heart of a comprehensive approach. But I think that it isn't just a matter of putting things together. It's not just a matter of adding development to security or adding civilians. It's to do them together, you need to do them in a different way. And what human security requires is that the military operate in a very different way. Protecting people is very different from defeating enemies or protecting food convoys, as Josette suggested. Creating humanitarian space or creating space where people can debate their future without fear is very different from trying to win. And it requires a very big change in the way the military operate, the kind of equipment they have, what they're able to do. It's no accident that civilians are reluctant to work with the military. If the military are doing traditional war fighting, then they want to get out of the way. You can't do development if there isn't stability. So it's all about trying to change the nature of the military task as much as it is about adding civilian to military. Now let me turn, because I've got so little time, to NATO. And I think this is a fantastic opportunity. And the reason I think it's such a fantastic opportunity is partly because I think the United States is finally having its perestroika after 20 years after the end of the Cold War. And I'm not talking about the perestroika, which is part of it, brought about by the victory of President Obama and the kind of way he mobilized ordinary people to support him. I'm also talking about the perestroika in the Pentagon as a result more of the experience of Iraq and Afghanistan than 9/11. I think the new ideas that are developing in the Pentagon around population security, around counterinsurgency, are terribly important and very close to the kind of thing that I'm talking about. I think Petraeus's injunction to live amongst the people or to live alongside the people is incredibly important and really did make a difference in Iraq. The American military started to play an enabling role instead of a much more destructive role. How similar is human security to population security? Well, I think there are two differences. First of all, human security is a goal, rather than a means. Population security is a means to defeating al-Qaeda or to defeating enemies. Human security is the end. You may need to defeat al-Qaeda to get human security, but it's the other way around. And the key, human security is the central issue. Protecting civilians is the central issue. And the second thing is that with human security, by and large, civilians are in charge. The role of the military is in support of the rule of law, rather than a military-led operation. And that does have big consequences, which I won't go into now, for how you judge civilian casualties, whether you operate according to human rights law or whether you operate according to international humanitarian law. A way I've thought of saying it is that counterinsurgency is sometimes dealt with as the soft end of the spectrum of war. I would say counterinsurgency, at least the way Petraeus defines it, not necessarily the way it was defined in Chechnya or Sri Lanka, is the hard end of human security. And I suppose what I would like to see is a shift in NATO's thinking from the spectrum of war to the spectrum of human security. And what would that mean? It would mean actually operating globally, doing the kind of thing Mr. Baradai talked about. It would mean engaging with others and recognizing that NATO has something to offer, but only together with others. I am coming to the end. I just want to say, it would mean, for example, the strategic collaboration that Dimitri Trentin talked about. I think we should have strategic collaboration around human security. Sorry. We should have strategic. Now, the last thing I wanted to say was that I agree with all those people who says there needs to be a process and who say that more people need to be in the process. A lot of people mentioned under 35s. I would mention women. But also what I would say is it needs to be the stakeholders of human security. So it needs to be the other agencies, the United Nations, the European Union, the OSCE, but it also needs to be civil society, particularly civil society in war zones, Afghanistan, for example. And it's not in order to publicize what NATO is doing, it's in order to learn how to do this, to get ideas, get new perspectives, understand what military people call the ground truth. Final end point. I actually think this is a very big shift, and it's a big cognitive shift. It's about human equality, which we all take for granted, but we don't actually do in practice. It means that the life of an Afghan is equal to a NATO life. It means that civilian protection does actually come before force protection. And that, although that seems very, very obvious, it's incredibly difficult to do in practice.
I think a question is going to come up at some point that you talked about this need for a NATO shift, but then you talked about the ideas taking place in the United States, and the question will be as to whether this is going to be something done by the alliance, or as is often the case with an alliance, it will be done country by country at different speeds and with different capabilities. And the Dutch and the Canadians may say, well, we've had our 3Ds. We've always been putting civilians at the heart of what we do. But I'll hold on to that because I'm going to change to Sascha Vondra. Sascha, you gave an interview as foreign minister 5 years after the Czech Republic joined NATO, and you were asked, well, what's the balance sheet? Should we have joined the alliance? He says, well, he says the balance is not a tragic one. He says there have been some pleasant surprises and there have been some rather unfortunate moments. Could you look forward now to the future of NATO and the new strategic concept and how it, in terms of human security and how NATO should be playing a role?
Yeah, I will try to do. I do not know where you have read this, but Jimmy was calling me on the short notice here to substitute for Ivan Krastev, who remained in Sofia with some high fever, and ask me to jump straight in with some bit more fun. So I will try to respond to that. And finding the inspiration in the European Parliament, where I had to spend a lot of time in the last couple of months, it's an interesting organization. It has its brights as well as the dark sides. And certain fun and a lot of jokes have certainly belongs to the bright side. And Right before President Obama's first visit in Europe, I have heard one joke about President Obama, President Medvedev, and President Sarkozy. And because of the matter of the political correctness, as well as because we are here, the NATO, I'm slightly accommodating the scene of that story. I'm putting President Medvedev aside for the purpose of this meeting. I'm upgrading President Sarkozy from man number three to man number two. And I'm adding, and it's up to you whom you want to imagine, whether President Klaus, President Kaczynski, or somebody else from Central and Eastern Europe. So those three gentlemen are standing on the seashore. They're at the end of the bay. There is a distant island, and they decided to cross the sea to reach the island. President Obama goes the first, and with an easy, comfortable walk, is crossing the sea, and in a minute is standing on the island. Then upgraded President Sarkozy goes as the second, with some roughy, uncertain, slower steps. He's reaching, after 5 minutes, the island too. And then the last one, for example, President Klaus is making first 3-5 steps and the water is just reaching to his head. Doesn't work, simply. And at this moment, on the other side of the bay, the President Sarkozy is asking President Obama, "You did not tell him about the stones?" And President Obama reacts, "Which stones?" So I think that our problem is that we terribly need the stones to lead us our steps in this very uncertain environment. And without any doubts, this environment and the security needs are pretty much different from what was during the Cold War era. And your question whether we would have serious challenges are very much different from what we have seen in the last couple of years. My response is yes. Whether the response to this entirely new situation is a total revolution within NATO, and simply to left the concept of the collective defense and to choose the concept of some kind of a human collective security, my response would be we have to be careful here. Certainly, we have to follow the steps responding to the human security needs, but not to the price that we are resigning on the collective defense. And at the same time, in these new missions, we have to be selective. Simply, we need to know how many stones we need. We have to have the size of the stones that we would be able to walk through, and not to slim down. We have to have enough resources to buy or to have the proper stones, and we have to collect the stones which I think enjoy the support of all the members, including our public. So certainly, the characterization of this environment, you know, is not so much about the quest for territory as much as the quest for influence, economic resources, and the profit. The globalization is, of course, a very different factor from what we have seen before. And, of course, we have the lack of single, clearly defined enemy. So here comes the problem and the challenges. First is that we have the problem of the purpose, so uncertainty and the complexity of this environment of and our understanding of the environment is a tough challenge. Another challenge relates with the capacities, because, you know, we are in the danger of the overstretch. And just right now, in the current economic situation, with the budget deficit, the double digit for some of us in the room for the years to come, I'm afraid that the defense budget will be the first to be cut. And I, you know, you can already read the various recommendations, and not just by 10%, but in some cases even the recommendation to cut them by 30%. And given the circumstances of, in particular, the European states, where you have a lot of those fiscal needs, just a mandatory one from the law to the various social payments, then the defense budget is one of the many, one of the few options to take in. So, and some of you have already talking about the need of this public outreach and generating the public support, and it's extraordinarily important. But again, the paper, the concept, is not going to deliver this task. It must be the operation itself. Either, you know, if this is a war, then this is the victory. If this is the humanitarian operation, that's the humanitarian relief. If this is a peacemaking operation, it's achieving the peace. So,
Sasha, I'll give you an extra minute because you told a good joke, but you should wrap up soon. Your 6 minutes is up.
Yeah.
I'll give you a bit of extra time because you told a good joke, but you, otherwise it's your 6 minutes is up. You can wrap.
Okay, so to wrap up, I think, A, we need to rejuvenate the Article 5. It was not so much mentioned here. There are two examples since the last strategic concept. Our immediate reaction after 9/11, we invoked, but we, in fact, did not know what to do. Another example is immediately after the Georgian crisis, we suddenly recognized that there is not a defense planning for the new members who are already the part of the alliance. So if there is a need to invoke the Article 5, in many cases, we do not need what to do. So that's number one. Number two, the operation with the humanitarian purposes, yes, but we have to be selective. The Balkans operation, the Horn of Africa, to a certain extent Afghanistan, that's where we can prove NATO is the right organization to tackle. But, for example, you remember when you were in Pakistan, this attempt of NATO to help during the earthquake, I think it can serve as just the opposite, rather the negative example. And the last, the third comment is this. I did not hear so much about the need to make the transatlantic link strong again. And it brings me, it's not just the case for NATO. It's also a huge challenge in the economy. It's the huge challenge for Federal Reserve Bank. It's a huge challenge for the European Reserve Bank, because if the effect of the current global economic turmoil is dollar going down, China reorientating itself, the last sentence, and then the Eurozone is under the serious tension. And here there must be a coordinated policy over the Atlantic, because we are facing a potential problem that this debate is just a theoretical one, and that the practical development would be a very, very much different. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Sasha. I've got some questions and comments. Just before we move them, I just want to just get a sense of the room. I know it may be difficult to put people into one side or another, but what we've heard here is people talking about new challenges and new tasks. But we also heard earlier in the day people saying, well, let's concentrate on what NATO was established for, the founding principles, what NATO is good at. How many in the room, if a show of hands, would actually want NATO to start looking at some of the new threats? The food security, the energy security, the kind of things that Josette was talking about. How many would want NATO to start moving sideways a little bit to confront these new challenges? And how many think, well, actually, our resources, our capabilities, our budgets, our will is strained as it is. Let's just go back to basics and focus on what NATO is good at. A smaller minority. Okay. I wanted three questions to people were questions about humanitarian and military alliance. I have Mr. Korski, Mr. Stewart here, and also Anne Dayton. So let's start with you, Daniel Korski.
Thank you very much. Daniel Korski from the EC4. Mrs. Sheeran, you talked about the need for WFP and NATO to collaborate more effectively. You had a pearl string of great sort of success stories. But isn't the problem that we face that in many countries where we would like to assist, for example, Pakistan, our mere presence or our association with the assistance, the association in particular of the United States and the NATO alliance representing the West, undermines our delivery of aid. People simply don't want the things that we would like to give because they come from us. And when we look at the Pakistan earthquake example, the truth is NATO was helpful, but it probably wasn't as cheap or as efficient as the humanitarian organizations are when they deliver things themselves. So in that context, you know, how do we actually collaborate when collaboration with NATO can in fact undermine the very objectives that you seek to achieve in places like Pakistan?
Thanks. It's Stuart Eldon, the UK Permanent Rep. Josette, thank you for your contribution. It was amazingly refreshing and music to my ears. I'd like to know two things. Firstly, is WFP the same as the other humanitarians? Do they think the same way as you do about working with the military and working with NATO, or is food security something special? And if it is, why? And secondly, what are the difficulties about working with NATO from your perspective? We need to know this if we're going to write this into the strategic concept, and it goes a little bit back to what Mary Koldo was saying. There is a tension, I think, between a military alliance, and Lawrence Friedman brought that out very well this morning, based around collective defense, which this organization is and will continue to be, to the shift to a human security viewpoint, and how do you reconcile that? Thanks.
Thank you very much, Anne Dighton, University of Oxford. Can you hear me? We've been asked to think out of the box, so perhaps I could ask Josette counterintuitively, rather along the lines of what Dan was saying early. My own view on hearing her very moving intervention was that NATO, as it is presently constructed, shouldn't be doing this kind of thing. We're a Western defence alliance, but surely the UN should be better empowered, whether it's armed forces or gendarmerie, for this kind of support. And maybe NATO should be doing training, maybe even they should be doing double hatting, which we're all getting quite good at, but this doesn't seem to me to be a NATO core function. It may well actually be more important than some of the NATO core functions, but I would very much like to know her views on whether, in fact, to be able to call upon UN gendarmerie if necessary would not be more appropriate for the kind of work she's trying to do. Thank you.
And Lucas, I think you had, where's Lucas? You had a similar question.
Yes, exactly. These are all nice examples.
Identify yourself.
Łukasz Kulesa, Polish Institute of International Affairs. These are all fine examples, but actually there's a danger that you're going to be used by NATO, used and abused probably, because of course, assisting you and other organizations in a given crisis would also fit the agenda of NATO. So there is a big danger of the impartiality of the humanitarian organization, be it intergovernmental or NGOs, being compromised and even the personnel being put in danger because of being associated with the political agenda of the NATO alliance. So how would you comment that?
Okay, I think I'm going to let you answer those questions. They're all quite similar, Josette. But Mary may have something to say, because obviously food security is part of human security. But I think we should agree that Jaap Dupschep should be able to keep his red cup, no matter how this conversation ends up. You don't have to give it back.
Should I jump in now? Or okay. I don't have all the answers, but I am haunted constantly by the observation that, for example, in Somalia, I knew if the supply chain got cut, that you can just write the story of what will happen, and the world would be doing a post-mortem, how did this happen? And all I know is there must be a better way to do this, because it's not the intent of the world for that supply chain to get cut. So we're living in a more complex environment. We feed 4 million people a day in Darfur. I had 43 of my drivers kidnapped and missing in action this summer. And so we have to face the fact that in order to keep things stable and to provide minimum protection for many populations, it's more complex than it was before. It just is. And so we are dangerously close with many populations of not being able to offer any protection whatsoever. And then you're down to dramatic solutions or none, all or nothing. And I think this ability to provide humanitarian space that was talked about becomes very important. And I'm really just glad to have the dialogue to say it's really often shaky out there on the front line of what we're doing. So when you're relying on our organization to be the lifeline to 100 million people, we have to have an honest dialogue that we don't really have all the capabilities and understanding and access that we need. Now, neutrality is important. The only protection that the World Food Program has, and one thing I'm proudest about, is pretty much everywhere. We are respected and known by all parties for only caring about reaching those people trapped and separated from hunger. And the ability for us to keep that reputation that we act based on needs, not which tribe, not which faction, but based on assessed needs, and we do not do it at the behest of militaries or parties or others, is very critical. But I think there's a space where we need help. Now, notice in the string of pearls I laid out that, interestingly, the Jordanian military helped us. The Saudi Arabian military helped us. The Indian military helped us. The Pakistan military and NATO. I don't think we're talking about just a NATO thing. I think we're talking about a dialogue where we respect space. I noticed in the discussion paper it said, NATO cannot, does not want to be the civilian operation. But I'm a little surprised coming into the humanitarian world, as I have from different background, to really understand how ad hoc it is. I don't know how much money I'll have in 12 weeks. I don't know where the supply chain will be. I'm a spot buyer. I have nothing pre-positioned. Last year when I got a call from the leader in Afghanistan saying they have no food in Kabul, I borrowed food from a boat going to Darfur.
Good, thanks.
So that type of, we can normalize and strengthen together this capability in the world without compromising, I think, the independence and missions of the institutions.
Thank you. Mary, just a quick comment from you then.
Very briefly, I think my point is there is a huge security gap, and in the next two decades with climate change, with financial crisis, is going to get worse. And we need to adapt our security capabilities urgently. And when you're a Pakistani or whatever, or a person in Darfur, I don't actually think it matters whether it's an American or who it is, as long as they're helping you. If they're shooting predators at you, then you certainly don't like them. But if they're there to protect you, you do. And linked to that, of course, I'm also advocating that if NATO were to move towards a human security, it would become part of a global security architecture. It would fill the huge gap that the UN has at the moment in that it's not able to do Darfur and other things.
Now, a number of people wanted to raise most conceptual issues, and I want to turn to some of them. Admiral Di Paolo from the Military Committee. Yes, let's keep our comments.
I am Admiral Di Paolo, the chairman of NATO Military Committee. We are talking a lot of 21st century geostrategic environment, the globalized world. then I wonder if we are not looking at what we define and agree as the cornerstone of the alliance, the collective defense, Article 5, with a 20th century eyes. So we are looking to that article with 20th century eye in a 21st environment. So I wonder if it's not a more relevant in the 21st century to pursue true collective security, cooperative collective security, which include also filling the security gap, filling, including humanitarian dimension, the proper way, or maybe the better way, to pursue the collective defense of Article 5. So what I'm questioning, the interpretation that we do today of a collective Article 5.
Thank you. Otto? Yes. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you very much. I'm Otto Hieronymi from Webster University in Geneva. There are two words that have been kind of avoided in this projection for the 21st century. But two words that have sort of defined the success of NATO the first 40 years, and I would say even the last 60 years. And one is deterrence, and the other one is prevention. And I think the role of an organization like NATO was to deter aggression and to prevent also internal threats. And I think NATO was obviously the ultimate organization that has provided security from the threats from the outside and freedom and security on the inside. And of course, for that, there were two words that are extremely important. One is solidarity. And obviously, NATO would not have been the organization it was if solidarity hadn't been there. The security of Luxembourg was just as important as the security of Canada and the United States. So I think what you are saying is, and what we have heard is, what do we have to do once the deterrence proved to not was no longer credible, when we have not had enough solidarity to prevent? And I think food security is a typical example of that. Sorry.
Thank you very much.
I got carried away.
Johannes?
Johannes Ahlefeld, Security Policy Advisor to the Social Democrats in the German Parliament. I wonder whether a debate has taken place in the NAC on what I would consider the most forward-looking document on security policy challenges in the 21st century. That's the report by the Commission on Threats and Challenges provided for the UN Secretary General in 2005 for the Millennium Summit. And I would ask the panel what they think that we could be learning from kind of looking closer at what the analysis of the intricacies and links between the different problems are. And possibly an aside question to Josette Scheran, what's your view on sanctions as an instrument? Thanks.
Giancarlo? Yes, please. Microphone in the back.
Thank you. I'm Giancarlo Aragona, the Italian ambassador to London. Now, I would like to press Mr. Vondra on his view about rejuvenating Article 5. I draw also from the comment made by Admiral Di Paola that this is going to be a very crucial question in the framework of the new strategic concept. If we answer satisfactorily to this question, we probably will have a good building block for the concept. So could you give us a few of your ideas about this?
And Valentina, you also had a question for Vondra. Where's Valentina?
Oops. Yes, my name is Valentina Bopp. I work with the EU Observer here in Brussels, and my question was to Mr. Vondra from his experience of the former Czech EU presidency, how works with his European partners go in regards to this direction that he mentioned, rejuvenating Article 5 and pressing more for guarantees for new member states to have these security guarantees. Thank you.
Won't you just hold on a second, because we want to keep very much to time, so we only have a few minutes. And Mike Williams and Solomon Dukar both had a similar question, which I think at least we should at least air them here. So let's just have them before.
It was really just briefly the fact that there's a lot of talk of interagency or international organizations cooperating, but the track record has been pretty dismal between the UN, just say the UN and NATO. And how do you overcome this? It's a domestic problem in the US and the UK, the interagency process. And internationally, it's very easy to say that we should all work together, but actually coming up with how you get over the bureaucratic turf war is getting the UN to function within itself properly, and then getting NATO to input into it, and the EU is the same sort of thing. So I think the rhetoric is lovely. I think the reality from the last 6 years of my studying this is that it doesn't really work. So it's a note of caution, I would say.
And the Romanian ambassador to NATO?
Well, just to add up, Sorin Ducaro, Ambassador Romain to NATO, how far can we go, if ever, to bring an institution dimension to kind of interagency cooperation within NATO, given the multifaceted aspects of security that we have discussed, in order to make the response more efficient?
Okay, so we've got questions about cooperation, interagency rivalry. We've got some definitional issues, including concepts of human security. There's one last question for Mary, and then I'm going to go back to the panel from your. Yes.
My name is Huurt Eschvogel. I'm with Dutch newspaper NRC Handelsblad. I'd like to ask Mary Koller, you said in human security, civilian protection should become before force protection. And that is, of course, very difficult, you said. I wonder, how could you make political leaders, military leaders, to openly agree to this concept, to this change?
Okay. Let me go to you first, Vondra, because some questions were used specifically about concepts, including you mentioned Article 5.
I think Article 5 it's still and will remain the bedrock of the alliance. And we have to take this as a serious commitment, and simply if we recognize 5 or even 10 years after the NATO enlargement that there is not any concrete defense planning, how to defend the members of NATO, I think this was a mistake. And if we are now discussing about a new strategy concept, this is the best way how to correct that mistake. But then, of course, it opens a larger conceptual debate. Somebody has mentioned whether there is not the time for a bit of reinterpretation of the meaning of the collective defense. And as I told that, in the current age, that's not as much as in the past the quest for the territory, but rather for the other gains, then maybe the question is whether the interpretation of the collective defense has to be so much connected with the territory, or whether we can go in the reinterpretation of the collective defense a bit more far. And here I think I would be open for that, because basically the matter of fact is that the population, even of the citizens of our nations, are not so much connected with the territory as were in the past. That's the effect of the European integration, that's the effect of the globalization, that's the effect of spreading of the informations and all that. So certainly I think it's worth of attempting. And then the next question was whether I was engaged during the presidency to that particular debate. I think the easy answer is no, because this is about the NATO strategy concept. And but the fact is that when we were serving in that particular role, it was immediately after the Obama's inauguration, and we were preparing some proposals set for the future agenda, but until the end of April or early May, the administration was setting up, so it was a time of exchanging certain views, but it was not the time for action yet. But certainly the time is now coming. So There are the two important challenges which are very much interconnected with the future of NATO, and one is the NATO-EU relationship. It was mentioned here, it's an institutional issue. And the second is what I wanted to say at the end of my speech, and that's the relations between the US and the EU.
Thank you.
And here, to make the transatlantic link stronger, to be able to respond to all those challenges, or at least 50% of those, what has been mentioned here, it's a must.
Thank you. Institutional strength, partnerships, Mary?
Well, just very briefly, first on Prague, we did actually have a human security meeting in January with the Czech Parliament and with Charles University, and there was a lot of interest and a lot of debate. Secondly, of course, Sasha and I knew each other well before 1989 because we were both working on peace and human rights struggles. And I think the human security idea actually came out of that, in my view. If we're talking about Article 5 or we're talking about solidarity, I think what human security is about is extending what we take for granted within NATO, that is human security, to the rest of the world. If you like, rather than saying, get rid of Article 5, we're talking about extending Article 5. You could say that the Charter of the United Nations, which makes war, starting a war illegal, is actually a global Article 5. So I think that's the way we should try to think about
it. Just a very brief comment, because the force protection versus civilian protection, and then the document that was mentioned.
Yeah,
just
I'm
very
going
quickly, because we're running to the end.
Very briefly, because they're connected. Interagency cooperation. I think there are huge problems working together with institutions. Effective multilateralism is very difficult. But I think what is required is conceptual coherence. It's very difficult to get institutional coherence. But if you have a shared concept, everything becomes a lot easier. And that's one of the reasons why I'm very keen on human security, is that I think it would provide a common narrative. On the civilian protection versus force protection, somebody said NATO, to be popular, has got to be effective among its citizens. I also think it's got to be effective abroad. I think actually if you were doing human security in Afghanistan and people saw that we were actually helping to prevent the Taliban, we were helping to create stability in Afghanistan, NATO would be immensely popular. One of the reasons it's unpopular is precisely because we're seeing not only soldiers' deaths, but also deaths of civilians. And actually, I think we live in a world where people have a lot of... For me, what globalization means is that we are conscious of all of being human beings, and we do care about what happens in other places.
Thank you, Mary. Very short comment by you, Josette, please.
Okay. Just to take the question on cooperation, I always think cooperation on what? You always have to have a goal. And what I find where it doesn't work is when you sit around a table saying, we have to cooperate, we have to cooperate, let's cooperate. Let's just take Afghanistan for a moment. I understand from your discussion paper, huge priority for NATO. WFP is feeding about a third of the population. I don't buy any of my food there. I'm one of the largest purchasers of food in the developing world. I buy from the war zones in Congo, and we've reopened roads there. It is a big idea to think, could we buy wheat from Afghanistan? We're guaranteed purchase, and then actually Afghanistan starts feeding itself. Could you produce the biscuits for school children in little factories there? But this requires a dialogue of which there's no natural place. Now, whether or not NATO needs to play a role in that and be a home for pulling together some of that dialogue is a good question, but it's many of your governments that are behind humanitarian action, and many of your governments that want to avoid the worst forms of human suffering and the need for more aggravated military action. And so, again, I don't have the questions, but I do know when you sit people down with a particular task and you get the right mix of people, it's why I want to thank the Secretary General, because I think the fact that we're having this dialogue with the players here today represents a paradigm shift in how we're willing to approach these problems. And in my world, it's a breath of fresh air also, just to mimic what someone said. We don't get to talk to all of you about what we see on the front lines and how to help cool things down and stabilize things. And one word from you to your parliaments can help stabilize our world greatly.
Thank you, Josette. Food security, human security, as I mentioned earlier in the day, we heard about energy security, climate security. What we mean by security and security for whom is going to be at the heart of this debate on a strategic concept. We could only raise some of the issues here today, and I always love following back on that old Cold War saying by Antonio Gramsci about optimism of the will and pessimism of the intellect. But hopefully between those two things we can find a way forward. Thomas Rees will do the next session, which will talk about the risks, the capabilities, and the weaknesses. But I think I'd first like to thank Josette and Mary and Sasha. Thank you to all of you for your comments, and join us now.
And Lisa, a big thanks to you too.
Thank you.